This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today, we're joined by a live panel of political analysts, as well as our Statehouse reporter to catch us up on election results in Indiana and across the country. We'll also unpack the president's late night address and its implications. If you have questions or comments on our show today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. Also, leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. We just need your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we will do our best to get it into the conversation today. Again, 866-476-3881 to leave us your voicemail. We would love to hear your voice in the conversation. Another way you can do that is to send us a high-quality audio message with our smartphone app, All In Vox Pop. It's free and it's very easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. And we're joined now by two guests who were with us last night when election results started coming in. Laura Merrifield-Wilson is an associate professor of political science at the University of Indianapolis. Welcome back to you, Laura.
Thank you for having me.
And Andy Downs is director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics. Andy Downs, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Laura, what are we seeing with voter turnout for this election?
Incredibly high numbers. And I think as a political scientist and just a general lover of democracy, this is really exciting. We knew we were giving people more options than they'd had in the past, in part inspired by COVID. Indiana is one of the five states that decided not to pursue the no excuse mail-in voting, but we still had absentee voting if you qualified for one of the 11 reasons. We did have early voting, and in Marion County, you had the voting where you didn't have to go to any particular precinct. And I think you saw people took advantage of this. People saw this as an opportunity to engage with the system. And of course, you know, still counting ballots, still looking at mail-in returns. We don't know all the exact numbers, but what it shows is a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of engagement, and great numbers in a state that oftentimes nationally gets really poo-pooed for not being more civically engaged. We usually have low voter turnout. I think we can be pretty excited by what our numbers looked like last night.
And there are a lot of answers to this question, some obvious, some not so much. But I want to get your perspective as a political scientist on this. Do you have a sense for why turnout's been so high?
I think there's enthusiasm. And I use that phrase meaning positive and negative. I think there's a lot of anger, a lot of anxiety, certainly a lot of attention towards issues that were inherently political. And a lot of times people think, meh, just the president. Ugh, I don't really care about the governor's race. However, their attitudes are politically, they don't feel as inclined to engage. 2020 was a very unusual year for lots of ways. I'm already talking about it in past tense. Do you like that?
We can't get through it soon enough.
Was an unusual year. I think you see people recognizing the importance of voting, and this was a way that they could participate in the system. They saw these things as being political, and they saw this as an opportunity for them to engage.
How competitive were the races in Indiana that we know about now?
Generally not very competitive, actually. And that's one of the things that I think is interesting to look at. Races we thought might be kind of competitive, and I know the fifth still hasn't quite been called yet, but even if we talk about the ones that have, right? The attorney general's race, that was going to be an opportunity for Democrats. They saw Jonathan Weinzappel as potentially taking over. That would have been a Democrat in the statewide executive offices. Haven't had one since Glenda Ritz. And ultimately, and not only did he lose, but the margin with which he lost to Republican Todd Rokita was fairly sizable. Even if you look at the governor's race, and that one was called very early, it wasn't a surprise in terms of the outcome. But again, just the difference in terms of how much Holcomb won by, we haven't seen that for a long time. So when you look at those races, a number of things that we thought might have been competitive and might have been close really didn't have that same kind of outcome that we anticipated.
Andy Downs, were you surprised at all by the results here in Indiana?
You know, given the amount of excitement, I think a lot of people were expecting better results for the Democrats. I think that the Republicans have got to be really happy with what ended up happening, because with a high turnout, they managed to win very significantly, which kind of allows them to say this is a Republican state. And why not say that? They have the statewide offices. They have supermajority controls in both chambers. They're certainly well positioned to do that. One thing I want to add to Laura's list of reasons that we maybe saw turnout was there was so much, I'll call it advertising, but we might want to think of it more as earned media about going to early vote. You know, think of the number of times that you talked about it on this show or other things that Brandon talked about or other. There was just a ton of it all over the place. Make sure you go vote. Make sure you go vote. Here's a way you can go vote. And I think for a lot of people, it was just a matter of learning that they could. And they realized, wow, this is much more convenient than waiting to vote on election day.
Laura Wilson, do you think that early voting or mail-in voting will continue to be a contentious thing to talk about as we wade through this? We still don't have a winner in the presidential race, and the president himself has pointed at mail-in voting as being a problem.
Unfortunately, it's become political, but I would encourage us to take the partisanship out of it for a second and look at it more from an accessibility perspective. Now, no doubt we want our elections to be legitimate, and we're not just saying, oh, we should just do online voting through the internet. I'm sure that'd be fantastic. No, you know, we're talking about this with restraint, but making sure that people do have the ability to participate in the system. And as we saw so many states utilize mail-in voting, even as Indiana with refraining from that, having the early voting options, we're allowing people to engage in a system in a way that makes it easier for them. And I would like to point out, like from the literature in the discipline, it has historically been kind of mixed, because a lot of times people that have used the mail-in voting option, some groups that benefit Democrats, particularly lower socioeconomic status parts of the electorate, but also groups that benefit Republicans in terms of that 65 plus age group. Right? So it hasn't always just benefited one party or another. And of course, 2020 is unusual, and we'll wait to see what those outcomes of those votes look like. But I hope we look at it as a way of how we can encourage more people to participate and engage in the system without, of course, encouraging voter fraud or manipulating the process in any way that we wouldn't want it to.
But do you think that this election, I guess, could have an impact on mail-in voting for future elections, both here and across the country?
Yeah, absolutely. People will look back and say, okay, do we like the way the process worked? Do we like the way the outcome looked? This was, in so many ways, this sample, this first opportunity to test something out. Right? And we'll be analyzing it for a long time to see whether or not we thought it worked well, what things we'd want to change. But it did provide that opportunity to experiment in a way we probably wouldn't have done if we didn't have COVID and everything else that really encouraged us to do that in the first place.
Andy Downs, in President Trump's address late last night, he said, quote, "Frankly, we did win this election," end quote. He had not won the election at that point, and he still has not won the election. What did you make of that address?
In many respects, I wasn't surprised by it. He pretty much told us he was going to say that, and he pretty much told us he was going to do things to make sure that counting stopped the moment he believed he was the winner. So it shouldn't be surprising anybody. I know there are a lot of people who are upset by it, and they probably should be, because he's saying that the process should not continue to play out the way it's intended to play out or written to play out. But it shouldn't surprise anybody it came out of his mouth and his Twitter feed.
He also said that he was going to pursue legal action over the election results, something that he's implied he would do for a while now, and specifically said that he wants to use that legal action to stop the counting of votes. Is there any basis for that legally?
Well, I actually want to point out to folks that, you know, we're talking about 50 different ways to run elections here because we have 50 different states, and there are different rules about when counting can begin and when it has to stop and when do you have to have the vote certified. So there are all these differences from state to state. To make a blanket statement that you want to stop the counting, that is, in many respects, the same way the president talks about a lot of things. He's reduced it to a phrase that people will understand, regardless of what the subtlety might be from a legal perspective in 50 different jurisdictions. So, yeah, I mean, an attorney will be able to find a way to make the argument. I'm not saying it's going to be a good argument or the appropriate argument, but they'll be able to find a way to back up that statement. And keep in mind, elections often end in legal challenges. To ask for a recount in many states requires a legal challenge to the outcome of the election. You're not saying you think that the election is absolutely fraud-filled and wrong. You're just saying, I want to count the votes again. Now, usually when people are saying they want a recount, they're usually making an accusation about something else, too, that says fraud. So just people need to remember this is not new.
Laura Merrifield Wilson, what did you make of the president's comments last night?
Well, I think agreeing with Andy, he said he was going to do it, and he did, so he delivered in that regard. At its very worst, I'd say it's reckless and irresponsible. I think at a minimum, it's misleading to say that. I don't get to just declare victory when precincts haven't been reported, when the AP hasn't called it, when the Secretary of State's in not just one, but as Andy said, 50 different states haven't certified these results. I think it can be really misleading to people, especially when you have simple, strong sentiments, these declarations that they don't look into any further than thinking, oh, that must be it. Of course, the president said that. Now, granted, many people understand the complexity of the issue. But again, I would go to the irresponsible and reckless. It's not claimed. You don't just get to say, well, I've won, and then it simply happens that way. That's not how the election process or system works.
Isn't the fact, though, that he wants vote counting to stop different from past attempts to get a recount?
I think so. I mean, part of it, you can go through like the legal process in a certain sense. And here he's trying to encourage, I think, the voters and the citizens to make this sort of demand. It's much more of a public appeal in a different way, like using the rhetoric of the presidency as kind of an outside approach.
There is contrast between what the president said and what the vice president said immediately after. And right after the president declared victory and promised legal action, Pence took the stage and said votes were still being counted and that they were on the road. That's a quote, on the road to victory. What did you make of the contrast between those two, if anything, in about 30 seconds?
It's the balance that they've always had for each other, right? Donald Trump is one character and Mike Pence is another. It's why they made a solid ticket in 2016. It's why they were on the ticket again in 2020. I think you always see that kind of calm reserve contrast that Pence kind of backs up and supports the president without doing so in so many words. And careful not to contradict, but maybe the clarifying statement, which in some ways actually does feel like much more of a contradiction.
I want to thank the both of you for taking the time in this first segment and also last night as well to help us unpack all this. Laura Merrifield-Wilson is an associate professor of political science at the University of Indianapolis. Laura, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Andy Downs is director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics. Andy Downs, always a pleasure. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with new guests after a quick break. We're talking about the results or lack thereof of the 2020 election. If you have questions or comments for us, we would love to hear from you. Get with us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881, or with our All In Vox Pop app. Get it wherever you get apps. It's called All In Vox Pop, VOXPOP. And it allows you to send us a high-quality audio message straight from your smartphone. I'm Matt Pelser. We are back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelster. Today we're talking about the election, the results, and the political holding pattern we're now in as a nation. And we would love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana and leave us a question or comment there, or leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. We would love to hear your voice in the conversation today. So leave us a message at 866-476-3881 or send us a message with our All In Vox Pop app. You can find All In Vox Pop in your phone's app store. We're joined live now by new guests. Jacoby Williams is a Ruth N. Halls Associate Professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies at Indiana University Bloomington. Jacoby Williams, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Bennion is a professor of political science at Indiana University South Bend. Elizabeth Bennion, welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Brandon Smith joined us last night, and he's here now. He's the Statehouse reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Brandon, thank you. And Brandon, if you're there,
we'll be here.
Great. Yeah, we'll start with you. I mean, we heard last night that Governor Eric Holcomb was reelected. How did that race end up? Was there anything surprising about the results when we look at the breakdown?
I think the only thing that really surprised me was how fast the race was called by the Associated Press. They called the race for Governor Holcomb pretty much immediately as the final polls in Indiana closed, which is 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central Time. So it's 6 p.m. polls closed across the state. But of course, because we have two different time zones in parts of the state, that means it's different times depending on where you are. But pretty much immediately at 7 Eastern, they called the race for Governor Holcomb. I think many people, if not most or all people, expected Eric Holcomb to win re-election. I'm not sure we expected it to be that decisive that fast. He won a decisive is I think the best word for it. He won a resounding victory.
How did his challengers do? Was there anything interesting there?
The thing that jumps out there is how relatively well the Libertarian candidate did, Donald Rainwater, in comparison to past Libertarian candidates. No Libertarian candidate in Indiana gubernatorial history has ever gotten more than about 3.5% of the vote. And we're seeing Donald Rainwater, we'll see what the final numbers are like, but he's up in the low double digits territory. That is certainly a huge accomplishment for a third party candidate in Indiana. The only time we've seen a third party gubernatorial candidate exceed that, I think, was back in like 1912, which was a weird election nationwide because you had Teddy Roosevelt and the Bull Moose Party and the Progressive, which was the Progressive Party, which is why a candidate here got so many votes. So outside of that, certainly in modern history, we have never seen third party gubernatorial candidates do as well as Donald Rainwater did. And if you listen to Rainwater's election night speech conceding the election, he was fired up. I mean, he was talking about how this sent a message. Now, we'll see whether that plays out politically over the next 4 years. We'll see if Libertarian candidates potentially can carry this momentum into the next gubernatorial race, which will be a really interesting one in Indiana because it'll be an open seat. But they certainly found something to be happy about when you contrast it to the Democrats, who just kind of got blown out.
For those of us who followed this race pretty closely, yourself included, I mean, the reasoning for so much of the vote going to Rainwater is pretty clear. But can you recap that for those of us who may not have paid as close attention, I guess? What was Donald Rainwater appealing to, and why did voters cast their vote for him in such large numbers?
Yeah, I can't tell you exactly why voters cast their vote for him, but I can certainly tell you what he was talking about. Before the election, or before election day, I should say, which was, it was all, in many ways, it was about COVID-19. So while Eric Holcomb was getting criticized from his left by Woody Myers and others for not doing enough to address the pandemic in Indiana, particularly recently as the governor moved to the final reopening stage and has stayed there amid much, you know, worsening and worsening and worsening numbers, you had Donald Rainwater, who was channeling a lot of conservative frustration and even anger over everything the governor had done up to this point, which was, you know, early on the stay-at-home order, then a mask mandate, well, a mask order. I'm not going to call it a mandate. It's not enforced. But Donald Rainwater really focused in on that. And he took his criticisms to other issues. But that was, I think, the main one, which was, you know, he thought Governor Holcomb had gone too far. And if you look at the number of votes he got in comparison to past third-party candidates, it seems like there were certainly a lot more Hoosiers who agreed with him this time. Though, again, it's important to focus on the fact that Governor Holcomb won a resounding victory.
I want to get to our other guests, but I have one more question about Donald Rainwater. I mean, was this a win for libertarians, or was this a win for those who are on the right side of Republicans?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I honestly don't know the answer to that. And it might end up playing out 4 years from now. In the next gubernatorial race, depending on who the Republican candidate is, might tell us something, who comes out of that primary, because we expect it to be a very competitive one. And then if there's a Libertarian candidate, which might even be Donald Rainwater again, what kind of success do they have in a very different environment? That might answer some of those questions. But boy, that's a good question that I just don't have the answer to at this point.
All right. Elizabeth Bennion is a political professor of political science at Indiana University, South Bend. Elizabeth, did anything stick out to you about the governor's race this year?
Well, really the same things that Brandon noticed, how quickly it was called and how well Rainwater did, helped organize the gubernatorial debates as president of the Indiana Debate Commission. One thing that I noticed in terms of comments on the debate, but also on President Holcomb's news conferences was how organized Rain Waters followers were. They made sure that they capitalized on every single opportunity to share their displeasure with the mask order. They made sure to make all kinds of, including name calling, to say how dictatorial they thought the governor was. So that strong libertarian argument, that strong argument of people to the governor's right. And you would see dozens and dozens of comments, all from this group who was highly, highly motivated and mobilized. They didn't have the same kind of budget that a Democratic or Republican candidate would have. So they used any free media that they could get, including social media.
And indeed, a lot of election signs out in rural Indiana for Donald Rainwater were seen. Jacoby, what are your thoughts generally about the results we got here in Indiana?
Just echo the same sentiments as Brandon and Elizabeth. The election followed the trend that I expected it to. The Republicans pretty much swept every race except for a few. The congressional district race is a lot closer than I expected it to be between Victoria Sparks and Christina Hale. I think maybe most folks are leaning towards Victoria Sparks winning that particular race. But other than that, everything fell in order as expected. I was surprised by the Hale margin of the loss, that it was a lot closer than I expected, which, again, gives some credence to a lot of grassroots organizing on the ground there. In the state of Indiana.
And to be sure, Brandon Smith, that race has not yet been called, or am I wrong about that?
That race has not yet been called. Victoria Sparks, I think, tried to sort of claim victory last night, while the Hale campaign sent out a statement that said, you know, we are still counting votes. We believe we have a path to victory. It is looking harder and harder. I agree with Jacoby. It is looking harder and harder to see that path for Christina Hale, as we have gotten more votes coming in from particularly Hamilton County and Marion County as they count ballots there, as the process continues to work. It's not, I don't think, impossible for her to win. If it were, I think the AP would have called it by now. That's I trust the Associated Press. That's always who I, and I think we as an organization at Indiana Public Broadcasting look to, generally speaking. But no, it has not officially been called yet.
Jacoby Williams, you talked about expectations. What is your was perhaps your expectation for that race?
Well, the race began to very early on get a lot of attention. It's one of the unexpected, possibly hopeful flipping of seats in terms of the Democrats gaining another House seat. Victoria Hale, I know from the national media, there was a lot of press and interest in the race here.
Christina Hale, rather? You said Victoria Hale.
Christina Hale. Gotcha. Thinking of Victoria Sparks, spent a lot of money within the state to circumvent that. It's very difficult to go anywhere in Hamilton and Marion County without seeing a Victoria Sparks sign. And I mean, I'm not talking some tiny size, some small billboard size signs. I mean, she spent a lot of money here to circumvent that process. So Democrats are hoping that Hale could win that seat, and a lot of folks on the left was hoping that that can happen as well. A lot of that fervor picked up after the groundswell this summer in terms of what took place with the George Floyd incident in Minnesota, and the way in which young folks and young voters began to flock to the polls with early voting, hoping that the Democrats could possibly steal this seat, but that just didn't happen.
Brandon Smith, we talked in the last segment about the fact that races in Indiana really weren't competitive this election. Would you say the same?
Yeah, almost to a surprising degree. Not so much at the statewide level. Holcomb winning, as I said, I'm a little surprised by how fast it was called, but not that he won, and not by a huge margin. I was a little maybe surprised, but I had with the attorney general's race, but I had Todd Rokita winning, and it looks like it's going to end up being roughly what we always expect, or in the past have expected, an attorney general's race to be, which is what's called a baseline race. Basically, it's the expectation that if a voter is Republican, they vote for the Republicans. If the voter is Democrat, they vote for the Democrat. in that race, regardless of the actual people involved, the actual candidates. And that's looking to be roughly what it ended up being. That's a bit of a surprise. But really what I'm surprised at is at the state house level, I was expecting closer races in multiple areas where Republicans are just running rampant. I mean, there was a lot of discussion and I think a lot of expectation, even from some Republicans, that Democrats would break the supermajority that Republicans hold in the Indiana State House. Not only are they not going to do that, Republicans, we don't know the final numbers in all of these races, but Republicans are going to expand their supermajority. I don't think a lot of people saw that happening the way it's happening prior to Election Day.
Elizabeth Bennion, let's talk about the underperformance of Dr. Woody Myers, the Democratic candidate for governor. Do you have anything to say on that as Democrats sort of pick things up after this election?
I think it is remarkable when we look at how well Holcomb performed and how much of the vote that did not go to Holcomb went to Rainwater instead of to Myers. One of the things that shows is that the candidate did not perform particularly well. The thing that makes that a bit surprising are the conditions, struggling economy, relatively speaking, and of course the pandemic and lots of dissatisfaction about how it is handled. I think you have a doctor who's running, right, who could speak to those issues and to some of those concerns. But in Indiana, most people seem to be comfortable with Governor Holcomb's happy medium approach. And remember, the governor every single week or more often has given news conferences and has millions and millions of dollars of free media coverage where he can assure the people of Indiana that he is doing what is necessary to keep us healthy and to keep our economy on track and rebuild. And so I think the governor also benefited in that way.
Do you think that the governor benefits from the contrast people see between him and the president, being that they're of the same party and that a lot of the Republicans have sort of followed in lockstep with the president on rhetoric and things like that? But we see something different from Eric Holcomb, it seems like. Do you think that he gets attention from people who might otherwise vote Democratic because of the approach that he takes?
Yes, there are a lot of moderates who like Governor Holcomb, and this does include some people who split their ticket and vote Democratic in other races. One of the things that we see is that the governor is very skilled in answering questions about Donald Trump. In almost every press conference, he'll get some question about something that Trump said or did, and he will never criticize the president, but he will draw a contrast and will stress that he speaks for himself and not for anybody else. And so he is much less likely to insult people. Civility is a big thing that Governor Holcomb talks about. He also distances himself from controversial tweets that the president makes and says he's focused on his job in Indiana. And so, or he'll say, well, the president was being sarcastic with the bleach comment, for example. He will take one sentence to say, you know, I understand some people are concerned about that statement. Now let's move on and talk about what I'm doing here in Indiana. And so he's very, very careful both not to get on the president's naughty list, if you will, and not to actively disagree with him or denounce him in any way, but also to provide a different kind of voice.
Let's talk about this result, Brandon, for a little bit more for the Democratic Party. I mean, going forward, do you think that there are certain lessons that the Democrats in Indiana might take from these results?
Oh, I think there could be. Well, let's differentiate between the lessons that they might take and the lessons that they probably should take, because we've seen in the past that those aren't always the same thing. There's going to be a lot of soul searching, or at least there should be, in the Democratic Party, the Indiana Democratic Party, after the kind of losses they suffered this year. I would be a little surprised if current Democratic Party Chair John Zody remains in that position. Democratic Party chairs don't usually last as long as Zody has. He's been there for, I think, 7 years now, which is a long time in the life of a party chair. I wouldn't be surprised if they bring in someone fresh, which is not to say that John Zody is the reason the Democrats lost, certainly. But when you have this kind of loss balanced against the expectations that you were going to do better, a lot of times it's time to shake things loose and just, find some a new direction. I will say this, something that I hear a lot of Democrats, not necessarily within the party, but just people who support Democrats in Indiana and who label themselves as Democrats, asking for is they want to see the party run progressive candidates, particularly for statewide offices, which they have really never done. Dr. Myers was certainly a Democrat, but I don't think a lot of people saw him as particularly progressive. Certainly Jonathan Weinzeffel is not. Jonathan Weinzeffel was in the mold that Democrats have been running statewide for decades, which is moderate, even conservative-ish Democrat, generally speaking. A lot of times they're men, a lot of times they're white. I mean, you saw that's Joe Donnelly, who lost 2 years ago. That's Evan Bayh, who lost 4 years ago. That's John Gregg, who lost 4 and 8 years ago. And I think a lot of Democrats are saying it's time to try something different, that this idea of being able to attract moderate Republicans or conservative Democrats isn't working. And a lot of people are wondering if those conservative Democrats really exist anymore or whether they've just become Republicans. And I think they want to try something different. Doesn't mean it's going to work. I'm not sure running a progressive statewide candidate in Indiana will work any better, but at least it's something new and different as opposed to the same plan that has failed to work.
We're getting an update today on the results from the 2020 election, and we will be back after a quick break. If you have questions or comments to share with us today, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881, and we'll do our best to get it in front of the panel in the last segment that we have coming up. 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our post-election day discussion. We have a live panel of political analysts and our Statehouse reporter to help unpack everything that's happening. As always, we would love your questions and comments. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. We have with us Jacoby Williams, Ruth N. Hall's Associate Professor of African American Studies at Indiana University Bloomington, Elizabeth Bennion, Professor of Political Science at Indiana University South Bend. Brandon Smith is with us. He's our Statehouse reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Elizabeth Bennion, I'm going to start with you. We talked in the first segment with Laura Merrifield Wilson and Andy Downs about President Trump's address last night, where he prematurely declared victory and then promised legal action to stop the counting of votes. What did you think about what the president said?
I think it was unsurprising because he had warned us he would do this, but also deeply troubling because he is arguing that the only way to avoid a stolen election is to stop the counting of votes, when in fact the opposite is true. These are votes that were cast in person early using the same procedure that people use on election day, but not yet counted in states like Indiana, where they don't count the votes until election day, or they were cast through a mail-in process that is legal in the state and has all kinds of safeguards in place. There are numerous academic studies on voter fraud. His own FBI looked into charges and allegations of past voter fraud. President Trump, remember, formed a commission to try to look at allegations of voter fraud in 2016. It had to be disbanded after finding no evidence to support these claims. And this is a claim that he made about fraud before a single ballot was cast. So we know that it wasn't actually a reaction to anything that happened on election day. Instead, he has a strategy which says, look, if I halt the process now, we could try to throw this election into the House of Representatives because each state casts only one vote and the Republicans have 26 delegations to the Democrats 22. That could give me a chance for a victory. And by the way, let's do it when we're leading in the Senate. That's not how you win elections. That would be stealing an election, which would be not to count legally eligible ballots that were cast in the 50 states in accordance with current state election law.
Do you think he's doing this, perpetuating these ideas for political purposes, or do you think he truly believes that these systems could be rife with fraud?
I, of course, cannot say what Donald Trump believes or doesn't believe, but my guess would be that he's doing it for political reasons, because he has determined that it would be a strategy he could use to try to maintain power. This accompanies other floating of ideas, such as staying more than 8 years in office, that are another reason why political scientists and others grow concerned about this circumventing of established democratic processes and procedures.
What would you say to someone who is worried or maybe even convinced that the time it's taking to count votes in some states is evidence of fraud?
There is no reason to believe that. In every single election, there are millions of ballots that are counted after Election Day. The system was, in fact, set up for it. If we think about the reason why the Electoral College does not cast their votes until 6 weeks after the election, that is because it was physically impossible to count all the election, all of the ballots at the time of the framers. So the system was set up for this. These are the same elected election administrators who run your municipal and state and national elections every year or two, and they have all the same procedural safeguards in place. There's no reason to believe that all of a sudden there was mass collusion across all states and all counties and all polling places and precincts. The other thing is, remember, when they're counting these ballots, there are Democrats and Republicans present to make sure that the process is fair and above board, and there's not any cheating going on.
Jacoby, I want to get your thoughts on this as well. What did you think of the president's address last night?
It's premature, and his address is premature and unfounded as usual. It's consistent with most of his rhetoric to appeal to his base. Instead of focus on him, I rather focus on the work that folks are doing in the democratic process. Several secretaries of states have made rounds on cable news networks, particularly in Georgia and Michigan, where the races are too early and too close to call at this time. And what they're doing is explaining to the American public via these news networks how the process works, that the votes are not certified at this time. They can't certify them until they counted them all, that most of what they're doing is according to state law. There's no fraud. Every vote will be counted. And a lot of this has to do with the work that Stacey Abrams and Fair Fight and others have done nationwide. They were in 18 battleground states, making sure that voter suppression efforts were not successful this time around. A lot of that had to do with early voting and mail-in voting. And maybe we could talk a little bit about what that voter suppression methods were later in the show, or maybe during Q&A. But I want to make sure that the secretaries of states are on record as of now, publicly speaking about how the process is working, how every vote will be counted. And then once that process is finalized, the Trump administration, if within a certain percentage point, can challenge it for a recount. And even with the recount, they don't expect much to change in terms of the final tally. And then those votes can be certified. So it's much to do about nothing in terms of the rhetoric coming out of Washington, out of the White House.
Well, let's talk a little bit about voter suppression. Elizabeth Bennion, we talked to people in the months leading up to this election about voter suppression. Can you talk about what suppression itself, I mean, really looks like in practice?
There are many forms that voter suppression takes place. One of the most obvious would be some kind of physical intimidation or violence, which is why people were concerned about the president encouraging his followers to become poll watchers, because the type of poll watcher that he's talking about is not actually certified by the counties and often not legally allowable to be in the polling place or interfering with people's rights to vote. And so that can be a concern. It is also suppression when you intentionally reduce the number of polling places, and you do it strategically in places where you believe that voters will not vote for you. And we see this quite often, particularly in poor Black communities where they have many fewer polling places and much longer lines. And so there are a number of ways that voter suppression can take place. Felon disenfranchisement laws are just another one. If you do not give people the right to vote back once they are released and expected to become full members of the community, or you require them to pay huge fines, almost instituting another poll tax. So there are a number of forms that it continues to take in 2020.
Are there any specific examples of what you would consider voter suppression happening in Indiana?
One of the things that we see can be not intentional voter suppression, but turning away eligible voters by mistake. And so if a student, for example, is told that they cannot use their state-issued student ID when they can, and that is what they've brought with them because they go to a large state university where they don't drive, but they are a member of that community for 4 years, that has the effect of disenfranchising them. And so that would be different than suppression, where you are intentionally doing that. And we do see some states passing laws to intentionally discourage students from voting. But that isn't the case here in Indiana. And so we do need to make that distinction between intentional targeting designed to keep people away from the polls and mistakes that get made and hopefully get corrected. This is one reason why it's so important for voters to know their rights and to know that they should never leave the polling place without casting at least a provisional ballot, and also asking for a supervisor if their right to vote is challenged.
Jacoby Williams, what about you? I mean, do you have any specific examples of what might look like voter suppression in Indiana?
In the state of Indiana, more so, in addition to what Elizabeth had outlined, not really. Most of it is, again, consistent with voter ID laws here in the state of Indiana. And they are quite confusing. Even some of the poll workers don't understand how it works. And so that's one mechanism that's been used in the past. By primarily the Republican Party, just to be frank about it. But in terms of where the elections are close, you can see the way in which voter suppression has worked and in favor of the Trump administration, and especially all these cases, the races were close now. Like, for instance, in Florida, it was mostly felon disenfranchisement, even though Amendment 4, the state legislature overturned those particular ballots and the way in which Republican state legislature reconstituted that. And look how close that race was when there were over 800,000 people who should have and could have voted but were denied. And look how close those rolls that particular race was. Here in the Midwest, it's mostly removing voter machines, which was Elizabeth outlined. That's why you get those long lines in highly Democratic areas. Also, voter ID laws in places in the Midwest and here in Indiana. And Georgia, Wisconsin, where it's close, you have people who were purged from the voter rolls in large numbers, the closing of polling stations in those places as well. So you can see the ways in which methods were used to circumvent the process. And because of that, the race is probably a lot closer than it should have been. So people like, again, I keep giving Stacey Abrams a lot of credit here because she is not just involved in terms of training grassroots activists, but also lobbying for new election laws, arguing in federal court against unconstitutional election systems to protect people in these ways. And so one method of that, of circumventing the process, whether voter ID laws here in the state of Indiana or closing polls or purging people from the rolls, is to vote by mail, is to vote early, and the absentee ballot. So those are one of the legal ways in which folks are able to circumvent the process. So typically, when we talk about voter suppression, we think about historically the 60s, right? You have billy clubs and fire hoses and dogs barking and biting. Those are that aggressive interference, some of which Elizabeth articulated in terms of using violence as a tool to control. But today, in our current context, voter suppression looks like administrative errors or user mistakes in some particular way. But they are these methods that I mentioned previously are just as intentional and insidious as those brutal and violent methods used in the past. So we need every vote to count. I'm hoping folks continue to be patient and allow those processes to work out. and voting, and because of the ways in which the mailing system is used as a way to circumvent suppression of the vote, is also a reason why Trump does not want those votes to count.
Brandon Smith, I want to shift gears here and talk about the race for Attorney General. Todd Rokita won. He beat Democrat Jonathan Weinzapfel. Was this a surprise at all?
To me, it's not a surprise that Todd Rokita won. It's what I predicted. It's what a lot of folks, I think, were predicting as we got closer to Election Day. I think what surprised me is that it turned out to be just like every Attorney General's race we've seen over the last several decades, or at least two decades in Indiana, which is what I talked about before. It's a baseline race. If you're a Republican, you vote for the Republican. If you're a Democrat, you vote for the Democrat. And the individual candidates involved don't make much of a difference. It's also why you have seen Democrats not particularly put strong candidates up the last few cycles, because it's hard to find what some refer to as a sacrificial lamb, someone who's going to run for a statewide office knowing that they're almost certainly going to lose. That wasn't the case this time. You had Jonathan Weinzapfel, who is a very credible statewide candidate for the Democrats. There was a lot of money in that race. In fact, Jonathan Weinzapfel had a lot more money going for him than Dr. Woody Myers had going for him in the gubernatorial race, which you very rarely see at a statewide level. And yet, after all was said and done, national groups, the Republican Attorneys General Association, the Democrats' counterpart to that, were putting money into this race. They were all looking at this race. And at the end of the day, it turned out to be pretty much a baseline race once again, which is Republicans voted for the Republican, Democrats voted for the Democrat, which means the Republican won pretty handily. I'm surprised by that. While I thought Rokita would win, I thought it would be a little closer.
We heard the news yesterday that Todd Rokita tested positive for COVID-19. Are there any updates there? Any sense of how he's doing?
We haven't gotten any updates since yesterday. They said the way that the campaign statement laid it out was that he had been told that he had been exposed to the virus, or someone with the virus, in a non-campaign activity. He then developed symptoms and got tested at that point, which is when obviously it came back positive. It said that he was doing well at home with his family. But I think it is also notable that they didn't do any sort of speech or anything last night, even from home. It was just a written statement. Now, we might end up seeing Todd Rokita here in a few days. But I think that speaks to perhaps the level of symptoms he might have been feeling. But that's honestly just speculation. All we know is that he was positive for COVID-19. He did have symptoms, and that his campaign said he was doing well at home with his family.
Elizabeth Bennion, I want to spend the last minute and a half or so with you, if we can. Both Twitter and Facebook have been making moves to highlight and sometimes obscure posts that are deemed misinformation. Some people see this as an important way to separate truth from fiction, but some are worried about the amount of power this gives to a small number of tech companies. What do you think about the conversations happening around social media platforms right now in our last minute?
I think it's very interesting that Facebook seems to be quite sensitive to the criticisms it got when it decided to continue running political ads and say it would not fact check them, while Twitter decided not to run those ads. And I think we've been seeing an attempt to compensate for this and some understanding of the public concern about this. Every time I log into Facebook, I see the winner of the 2020 U.S. presidential election has not been projected yet. And that a reminder that we need to wait for the votes to be cast. Before that, we were seeing reminders about the fact that some candidates may claim victory before the votes are counted, and basically urging patience. So it does seem like social media companies are trying to be part of the solution rather than the problem, because they're aware of the legitimate concerns about them furthering fake news, but also concerns about them being able to censor in ways that could advantage one candidate or another.
It's not over until it's over. I want to thank all of our guests for taking the time today. Elizabeth Bennion, who we just heard, is a professor of political science at IU South Bend. Elizabeth Bennion, thank you.
Great to be here.
Jacoby Williams is Ruth N. Hall's Associate Professor of African American Studies at Indiana University Bloomington. Jacoby, thank you for your insight.
Very welcome.
Brandon Smith is the State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Always great to have you, Brandon.
Thanks for having me on.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Our current technical director is Chris Flood. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about conspiracy theories making their way into mainstream politics. We're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In.